Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
That music made its way down from that hill and into the village, and everybody that was busy doing something stopped.
If you want to hear the rest of that story or hundreds of others, they're being told in our neck of the woods this weekend. It's the Wisconsin Writers Association Conference being held for the first time in our region in Superior. Plus,
you may have heard what can happen to words when the temperature falls to extremes. Nouns start to stick, adverbs get slick, and sentences crack at the seams.
How about we add a little poetry to the prose and further interpretation from local visual artists? Those stories and a regional news and review after this.
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
That music made its way down from that hill and into the village, and everybody that was busy doing something stopped.
If you want to hear the rest of that story or hundreds of others, they're being told in our neck of the woods this weekend. It's the Wisconsin Writers Association Conference being held for the first time in our region in Superior. Plus,
you may have heard what can happen to words when the temperature falls to extremes. Nouns start to stick, adverbs get slick, and sentences crack at the seams.
How about we add a little poetry to the prose and further interpretation from local visual artists? Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. If you've noticed an unusual number of writers in our area recently, maybe making a run on thesauruses at local libraries or bookstores, it's not your imagination. It's the Wisconsin Writers Association Fall Writers Conference, and it's indeed being held right here on Barker's Island in Superior. It draws writers from across the state, and it's not an accident that it's being held up here. The theme of the conference is celebrating Northland diversity in nature, and it's going on now. With me to tell all about it are Deborah Ray King and Thomas Wayne King of Solon Springs. Welcome to Simply Superior, Debbie and Tom.
Thank you.
Hi, Robin.
And I will quickly point out, if Tom's voice sounds familiar to you, we just had him on the show about a month ago, and Debbie also in her singing voice, although her speaking voice was a little under the weather. They were our musical guests over the summer at the time of their Lucius Woods performance. We knew this was coming up then, and several writers in the area called me to tell me. So, Debbie, you are the conference director. Why is it? We have writers here all year round. Who's going to be here that makes it special?
Well, we're very excited because we have 17 local writers that are going to be speaking either on a panel or as featured speakers. All of the talent is coming right here from the Northland. A number of the folks are familiar names, I'm sure. Tom Peacock is a gentleman who was a faculty member at UMD. He is our featured speaker. And then we have my husband, Thomas King, and we've got a number of folks, Gary Bolhauer, who is the poet laureate from Duluth. And I could go on and on with local names, but folks are going to be sharing their talent in a whole variety of genres. So that we've got novelists and we have memoir people and we've got editors and publicists. So we are very excited to explore the whole variety of writerly things from how do you get your book published and how do you select folks to represent you. And we want to get folks that have never written before but are curious about writing. And they're all going to be coming to Barker's Island for the very, very first time in the 74 years of the existence of the Wisconsin Writers Association. We're very excited.
Yeah, and I'll just jump in for a bit here. Right now, we have about 120 coming. And registrations in the past in southern Wisconsin, not to be too competitive here, but have been around 70 or 75. So we're just delighted that we have about 120 registrants. And then all of the presenters that Debbie talked about who are right from our region.
I want to plug some of our partners as well. We're very excited that we are partnering up with the Lake Superior Writers so that their membership can also come at the same cost as the Wisconsin Writers Association members. And a big shout out to the Duluth Superior Area Community Foundation, who gave us a generous grant that has allowed us to give the participants who are going to be attending today and tomorrow discount prices from what it would have been had we not gotten their generous grant. And it also gave us an opportunity that for something that your listeners can get in on tonight, on Friday the 30th, starting at 6:45, people can come in for $15 and listen to the entertainment for this evening. And it's going to be Carol Dunbar, who actually has a debut of her book, The Net Beneath Us, that came out this last Tuesday, and Michael Charette, who goes by Laughing Fox, who is a native flautist. And they are going to be putting on a stellar performance over this evening. So it starts at 6:45. We'll be taking registrations coming in starting about 6:15. Something to think about for a quick date night.
Sure. And those names are not unfamiliar to us as people who've appeared on the show. I also see Carol Dunbar is on the program, and she's shared her works with our sister program, Wisconsin Life. Let's listen to one.
I never used to think much about the environment. Don't get me wrong, I liked nature, but from a distance and out of my way. And then, 12 years ago, as I pushed my two children in their stroller, a mother bear lumbered out from the woods. She came from my right and crossed the road not 10 feet away, the soft pads of her feet the size of dinner plates. I stopped behind my stroller. My two children, ages 3 and 3 weeks, sleeping inside. Then again from my right, two cubs tumbled out into view, sensed my presence, then plunged back into the foliage. The mother bear from the side of the road turned, sniffed, and rose on hind legs to her full height. The sight of her magnificence sent me sinking to my knees. Not 3 days earlier, I had called the DNR and asked them what to do about the bears plundering our bird feeder.
Black bears are nothing to worry about, he said. The only time they're dangerous is if you get between a mother and her cubs. You don't want to do that.
We were all in a fairly straight line. The mother bear to my left, the cubs to my right, and me with my sleeping children in the middle. I had given birth only 20 days prior, and this bear had also just given birth. The moment sharpest in my mind is when we made eye contact. It was like finding a stranger across a room who shared your experience and your reaction, so the connection was instant. She wasn't just a bear. She was a mother who knew I had my young with me, just as I knew about hers, and she didn't like the situation one bit more than I did. Instead of a complete freakout, a sane and tempered reasonableness rose through me, what I am sometimes capable of when at my best. I saw that our stillness was our only way of communicating. And so it seemed to me that we agreed as mothers not to move. We kept a vigil. That bear stood at the edge of the road, and I crouched behind my baby stroller. Over and over, the cubs came out, squeaked, and hightailed it back into the brush. Finally, a car came along and the mother bear ducked away. I saw my chance. Using the car like a shield, I sprinted home with my stroller. I never saw those bears again. Our encounter could have ended any number of ways had that mother bear and I not struck an agreement that day, one that, for my part, I'm still trying to uphold. I no longer assume that what the beaver, the bat, or even an ant is doing isn't just as important as what I am doing. I feel a deep sense of loyalty to my environment, not just because I want to save it, but because I think it just might save me.
And that was Carol Dunbar reading from her work in a previous appearance on our sister program, Wisconsin Life. Carol is one of the participants at the Wisconsin Writers Association conference going on today and tomorrow at Barker's Island in Superior. We're speaking with Tom and Debbie King of Solon Springs. Debbie is the conference director, and you said you could still show up tonight, but tomorrow, what's the story, Debbie?
All registrations are closed on the 23rd for the face-to-face.
Totally understood. I want to get back to the basics of why have a writer's conference anyway? Writing is one of the few disciplines you can pursue totally on your own. In fact, sometimes you don't want anybody else around. I guess this is a long way of asking, what is the Wisconsin Writers Association and why?
I'll take that one, Robin. WWA, Wisconsin Writers Association, was founded in 1948 as Wisconsin Regional Writers Association, and it actually was begun by University of Wisconsin Extension by Robert Gard. He was based out of UW-Madison and the Extension office there, but he would travel the state with his notebook and with a big plug-in reel-to-reel tape recorder that he had in the back of his car, and he would tape people telling their stories around the state in farms and small communities and all over Wisconsin. So from that has morphed the Wisconsin Writers Association Incorporated, WWA and Lake Superior Writers, and also our colleagues in Thunder Bay, Northwest Ontario Writers Workshop, and other groups exist to give writers a boost, to give them a support, to help them to learn the craft, whatever their genre is, whether it's fiction or nonfiction or textbooks or poetry, songwriting, screenplay writing. And then we also exist to connect them with, as Debbie said, publishers and illustrators and others who help facilitate the production of your work.
All right. We're speaking with Tom and Debbie King of Solon Springs. Debbie is the director of the Wisconsin Writers Association Conference going on this weekend at Barker's Island in Superior. You mentioned Michael Charette. We've had him on the show before. Here he is telling one of his stories.
A long time ago in this village, there was a young man, and this young man fell in love with this young woman who was of courting age, and he couldn't talk. You know, he didn't have that gift to speak well. So he watched as other young men in the village would bring her gifts or, you know, whatever, what have you. And this kind of frustrated him because he wasn't doing that. You know, he was too shy. So he had heard that in his stories that there was a love medicine. And the spirit that carried this love medicine was the Ayabe, which is a huge albino elk that lives to the west. You know, and he thought to himself that if he could find this Ayabe, then somehow he could find this love medicine and he could give it to this young woman and she would know how he felt about her. So he packed up provisions and he went out into the woods and he found the biggest set of tracks he could find out there. And he thought to himself, this is it. This has to be the Ayabe. So he started to track it, you know, and days were going by and he would see flashes, white flashes out of the corner of his eye. And by the time he had his bow and arrow pulled back, it would be gone. And he kept following them deeper and deeper away from his village. And finally, he was exhausted from this traveling and this tracking. He made a huge fire underneath the cedar tree and he sat there staring into the fire, listening to the crackle and the pop. And he thought about the young woman that he had all these feelings for. And as he started to drift off into sleep, the night song kind of picked up. And he went to sleep. And the next day, when he woke up to a knocking. And when he opened his eyes, he looked up into that cedar tree and he could see a bird on the branch. And that bird was knocking on that branch, knocking holes in that branch. And after it was done, it flew away. And as it flew away, the wind picked up and it made this sound. He heard that sound and he knew instantly that that's what he was looking for. So he got up, he reached up into that tree and he grabbed a hold of that branch and he broke it off. And as he's looking at that branch, he's trying to figure out how to make it work. So he's blowing on it all different ways, but to no avail, he couldn't figure it out. So he did what was taught to him, and he took out some sacred tobacco, some esema, and he said a prayer to the spirit of that bird. And he offered that tobacco to that fire, and that fire turned that tobacco into smoke and brought his prayers up to the spirits. And as he sat there waiting for an answer, he fell back asleep. And in his dream, that bird visited him again. And he asked him, "What is it that you seek?" And the young man told him his dilemma. He told him about his heart's desire. He told him about the other young men in the village. And as the bird listened to him, you know, he felt bad for him and he took pity on him. And he started to tell the young man how to create that sound, how long to make that flute, where to put the holes. And he said, always remember when you play this to keep the image of your heart's desire in your mind, and you feel it in your heart, in your chichaguan. And when you blow it out into this flute, this bibi guan, it'll come out the end and it'll wabi guan. It'll flower. The Ojibwe word for flower is wabi guan. The Ojibwe word for flute is bibi guan. Two words connected. And as he created this first flute, he went back to his village and he stood up on a hill and he was looking down. He could see everybody working in his village, you know. Some people were dancing wild rice. Some people were picking berries. Some people were drying out meat. And some people were smoking fish. And as he stood up on top of that hill, he closed his eyes and he started to play with the image of his heart's desire where the spirits had told him to play from. That music made its way down from that hill and into the village. And everybody that was busy doing something stopped because nobody had ever heard a sound like that before. They all stopped and they all turned to the sound. Finally, that sound made its way to the wigwam, the home of the young woman. And as soon as she heard that sound, she knew instantly that that was for her. And she came out of her wigwam and she looked up to the source of the sound and she could see the young man standing up on that hill. And she always wondered why he never came and talked to her. And she went up and she stood next to this young man and she closed her eyes. And as she listened, she was so overwhelmed and amazed that somebody could express so much love without uttering a single word. And as he played, she realized that the music was intertwining their souls together.
That was a story by Michael Laughing Fox Charette and also his flute accompaniment. He's a participant in the Wisconsin Writers Association Conference at Barker's Island in Superior today and tomorrow. Debbie King, who else would you like to highlight?
Well, someone that I think a lot of your listeners will know is Emily Stone, who writes the nature stories for the Superior Telegram. She's a naturalist educator director of the Cable Natural History Museum, and she writes Natural Connections column, and that's in, you know, more than 20 newspapers across three states. And she is going to be presenting Natural Connections, Building Empathy for Nature Through Language and Story.
All right, let's hear some of Emily Stone's work from her Natural Connections Apple podcast.
Hello, this is Emily Stone at the Cable Natural History Museum in Cable, Wisconsin with your Natural Connections podcast. This week, we'll look at the science behind fall colors. We are lucky to live in this swath of the continent known as the Northwoods, where fall colors are spectacular. Go a little south or head farther north and the forest changes. According to John Pastor, Professor Emeritus from the University of Minnesota Duluth, we have the extremes of our climate to thank for this autumn show. There's something about the contrast of hot summers followed by frigid winters that encourages diversity in the shapes, colors, and lifespans of our tree's leaves. At the risk of being a killjoy, I'd like to remind you that fall colors are all about death. We'll start with a sort of obituary, then, an explanation of the leaf lives we lose every fall. As soon as leaves emerge in early summer, the trees begin again to form new buds. The basic cells for leaves, as well as shoots and flowers, are neatly organized and packed tightly within protective scales or thick fur. When warmth and sunlight return next spring, those buds burst and the leaves expand. It takes a lot of resources to grow a new leaf, and then maintenance costs continue as the leaf is photosynthesizing. I envision a worksheet full of math problems. Each species-specific equation contains different negative numbers representing the costs of tissue construction, maintenance, and reproduction. The more it costs to build a leaf, the longer it takes to pay off the overhead. Evergreen trees invest significant energy into building needles that can withstand harsh weather, photosynthesize at lower temperatures, and ward off pests. Pine needles live 2 to 3 years, and spruce and hemlock needles last 4 to 10 years. In contrast, cheap, flimsy birch leaves just last a few months. Neither way is necessarily better. Each strategy finds success. As sunlight wanes in late summer, it's time to close down the photosynthesis factories of leaves. Now the trees must try to salvage what they can. Nitrogen and phosphorus are sucked back out of the leaves and into the twigs, where they'll remain on deck to fuel next spring's leaf growth. The tree benefits from storing nitrogen and phosphorus above ground because the twigs thaw long before the frozen earth releases her nutrients. Finally, we've arrived at the onset of fall colors. Of course, they were there the whole time. All summer long, vibrant green chlorophyll was the star of the show and outshone all the rest. As chlorophyll breaks down and is reabsorbed, though, its trusty sidekicks are revealed. Orange carotene pigments captured wavelengths of light that the green chlorophyll could not, and then transferred that energy over to help fuel photosynthesis. Yellow xanthophyll pigments absorbed dangerous excess energy in the leaf and dissipated it as heat. This prevented cell damage and warmed the surrounding environment. Red comes next. Once the phosphates have been reabsorbed into the twigs, sugars in the leaves break down and form anthocyanins. Anthocyanins absorb UV light, especially at low temperatures. Like sunscreen, the pigments protect the leaf cells while they finish sending their nutrients back to the twigs. They can be blue or purple, but their most conspicuous form is red. Red is the only fall color that is created and not just revealed. While the forest becomes a rainbow, the deciduous trees are quietly growing several layers of cells across the base of the leaf stem where it attaches to the twig. Jack Frost doesn't kill the leaves, because the trees themselves do. Finally, the abscission layer weakens the leaf's hold on the tree just enough that a stiff breeze can whisk it away. That's it. The Northwood slides into the gray depths of winter, brightened only by the highly invested evergreens. Summer can't last forever, but neither can fall, winter, or spring. Next year, we'll get to watch the kaleidoscope of colors play across the landscape all over again.
And that was a selection from the Apple podcast, Natural Connections by Emily Stone. She's a participant in the Wisconsin Writers Association conference going on today and tomorrow at Barker's Island in Superior. With us is the conference director, Debbie King. And can we call you her right-hand man, Thomas King?
I'm actually left-handed, yeah.
Okay, her left-hand man. Right or left, how can we learn more about the conference or to participate online?
Well, the website for Wisconsin Writers Association is wiwrite.org.
Okay, one more time.
wiwrite.org.
Anyone else you'd like to highlight?
I think you'd really enjoy hearing from our keynote speaker, Thomas Peacock.
We can do that. Here's a reading he did at the Zenith Bookstore in Duluth that we had on the show a little while back.
The setting is Naglajawanong. That is our Ojibwe, what we call the Fond du Lac Reservation, just south of Duluth. So here we go. I am of the wolves from the hills that overlook the river that flows through Naglajawanong, the bottom of the lake, Kichigumi, the one that bears the likeness of a wolf. This has been our home for so many generations, we've long since lost count, since the times after the retreat of the last glacier, the one before that, and before that. I'm old, I suppose, 9 winters, certainly old for a wolf. I realized it when the pups began calling me Jiche, uncle, and started asking me all kinds of questions because I supposedly possess knowledge, have wisdom. I don't know about that. Jiche, they said, tell me about this. Uncle, tell me about that. At first I'd say, I don't know. And they'd walk away and I'd hear them whispering. He knows, he does, or he doesn't know. Maybe we should ask another uncle who knows something. Maybe this uncle is dumb. Most of the time, though, I'd say later, tonight, tomorrow night, after I've gotten approval through Gnu, Golden Eagle, the beta male, and then Ogima, leader, the alpha male, after the hunt, after this, after that, we'll gather in circle, we'll talk story.
And that was Thomas Peacock reading from his work. He's the keynoter at this weekend's Wisconsin Writers Association conference at Barker's Island in Superior. We've been speaking with the conference director, Debbie King of Solon Springs, and her right or left-hand man, Thomas King. Thank you both for joining us.
All right. Thanks so much, Robin.
Thanks, Robin.
Come on down, folks. It's going to be really great.
Coming up, now that we've invited writers to the Northwoods, how about adding some poetry to the prose and an interpretation of their works by visual artists? Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. So with homegrown talents like those we just featured, writers aren't just here for the weekend. Among our year-long wordsmiths are those concentrating on poetry, and several in Hayward have collaborated with local visual artists. The venue is the Out of the Woods Winery, and we're joined from there by co-owner Dan McLaughlin and the art coordinator for the project, Deanna Person. Welcome to Simply Superior, Dan and Deanna.
Hi there.
So Dan, you've added poetry and painting and other visual art to your winemaking. Tell us about your winery and what you do.
I'm the owner of Out of the Woods Winery, and I own it with my brother Jeff. And we have a gallery that we installed in the winery to honor our mother, who was an artist. So we feature local artists 3 to 4 shows a year. And Deanna Person coordinates that for us. She knows all the artists. She owned a framing shop in town. And she makes the whole thing work for us. I just say yes a lot.
And provide the wine.
Well, that's certainly important. Deanna, what is this particular project? And the area is Greater Hayward?
It's the Hayward area, and that embraces the small, many small towns around us, such as Cable and Stone Lake and such. And this particular show reached out to both the artists and poets within the area. So this has a double-edged uniqueness to it, which was delightful.
Mm-hmm. And you said artists and poets. How does that work?
Well, there's a fabulous poet here by the name of Naomi Cochran, and the two of us worked to coordinate the show together. So she reached out to poets and said, would you be interested in doing a collaborative? And she had many responses. I think maybe 36, 40 pieces of poetry were submitted to her. And I did the same with the artists. I said, do you want to be a part of the show? They said, yes. We sent them all the poems. They each got to pick the poem they wanted to interpret. They had about a 2.5-3 month window in which to get the piece created, and then we hung the show. Dan and Jess hosted an opening in which the artists and the poets attended, and the poets read their poetry, and the artists were able to respond and make comment about the work that they did. The show will run through November 30th.
And was the event the first time the poets saw the artwork?
Yes, it was the first time they got to see the interpretation. And I think what was interesting is that some of the artists wanted to talk to the poets, but that wasn't our goal.
Was that verboten? Were they not allowed?
Yes, it was. They were not. No.
What if they use, you know, that Google machine or something like that to find out? Or did they even have the name of the poet?
They do. They have the name of the poet. And if they were crafty, they could probably make the contact. But, you know, it's a fresher approach if you take it that way. And if you begin to talk to whoever the writer was, that's putting a responsibility to take their words as they meant them, as opposed to doing your interpretation as you read them.
Right. And who knows that your poets wouldn't have been Project Police and call you up, Deanna, and say, you know what, Johnny Artist just called me up.
Not going to happen. We're in Hayward, Wisconsin. It's a great community.
All right. Everybody loves each other. We are talking to Deanna Person in Hayward, Wisconsin, and also Dan McLaughlin of the Out of the Woods Winery, where there is an exhibit of poems and artwork inspired by those poems. And
can I share with you, too, that Dan and Jess promote the arts continually. So the bottles of wine that they create here, they use the artwork from area artists on the label.
So, Dan, does that mean that any of the art that was inspired by the poems might end up on a bottle of wine?
Yes, we had a lovely conversation with one of the artists about their work. And the trouble, of course, is they want to put it on a red wine. And red wines take about 2 to 2.5 years to mature. So, you know, it's a lengthy process. But, you know, we just let it roll until the wine tastes good.
Well, now that's funny you say that, because isn't it the bicycle poem?
Yes.
So let it roll.
So at that, we've got to hear the bicycle poem. And since we do not have the poets with us, and I understand, Deanna, you're right there in the gallery with the artworks and poems, will you do the honor of reading for us, please?
All right. Bicycling, a poem by William Noreen. Alone again in pedaling and heat, down the scorched road, surprised by the fervid moments of clarity amid the head's sweet dribbles, acid pearls of wisdom that blanch the face, that sting the eyes and all but blind me to a standstill. Remember our silver tandem love, riding the red cedar trail in summer, skirting along the wide, slow river, the limestone ruts ahead framed by lush green leaves. A picture out of a storybook, Wisconsin. You right there behind me all the way, no matter how far or fast we went. It seems like I did most of the pedaling, darling, and all the steering. Did I steer wrong somewhere? Now the frame is lighter and it lurches forward. The pedal seems to move much easier as I pick up speed, even into the ever emptier space. Sometimes I race in extremis. I rear back in ecstasy and call your name out loud into the high blue, but there is no answer.
And we have just heard the bicycling poem by William Noreen, illustrated, which you can't quite see on the radio, by Lisa Lovejoy and read by Deanna Person.
It's one of the poems in the dual exhibition called The Nature of Relationships going on at the Out of the Woods Winery in Hayward. What were some of the reactions by the poets to the work, the artistic work, when they saw it?
One of the reactions that really stood out for me, Dan may have another thought, but there was a poem that was written and read by Macy Washow, and it was called Last Lab. And it was about a stray coming to a home, about those seeing it, you know, turning their back and thinking it'll just go off. but those eyes were looking at them again the next day. And then she compared it, Macy did, to the children of Afghanistan, those that are left behind. And the visual image was done by Janelle Thompson, who is a beautiful watercolorist. And it has this distinct, tangible, sad-looking stray, mixed breed. And next to it are the eyes of the children from Afghanistan. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece.
I'm wondering how literal that visual image is. I'm trusting it was not of the ilk of the 1960s Walter Keen, later described or unveiled as a fraud, big-eyed cats and big-eyed children.
You know, no, there's not. And, you know, I love those Keen paintings, and I used to have them in my room.
Well, everybody did. That was
the
point. They were huge. Right.
She should have gotten her due. That you know, she was robbed, so to speak. But when you look at
I do have to explain to our listeners, people aren't familiar with that. There was a very talented female artist who was married to rather unscrupulous gentleman who misrepresented himself as the painter of those big-eyed cat images that you've seen all over the place, particularly in the 60s. They were, you know, terribly popular, but we're off on a tangent, and I brought it up. Sorry. So
that's all right.
Janelle Thompson did not do those.
She did not, but what she did do, she has two images. One is very overt. It's a watercolor of a stray mutt, ears a little cocked, and those soulful chocolate brown root bear eyes are just looking at you, and that just pulls you in. And in the mat next to it, it's all one unit, there's a very subtle Payne's gray and white painting and two pairs of eyes, one looking directly at you and one looking at you with their head slightly turned. And those eyes are as strong as the image of the dogs. They're two different painting approaches. Beautiful. Just beautiful. And it just says what Macy had written.
All right. So, if you will again, let's hear what Macy has written.
It's called Lost Lab. Lost Lab. Astray. He begged, sucked my heart into the swirl of his bottomless black eddy eyes. Eyes like those of the Afghanistan child handed above the crowd, overwhelming the Kabul airport, beseeching someone, anyone, to take him. I didn't give in. I didn't feed him. For then he would stay forever. But he was there the next morning, staring in the front door, while my pup wolfed his food. I wondered what's to be done with refugees who come with nothing. Hungry? Something had to be done. The sheriff's deputy said they try to find room in a shelter, but shelters here are already overrun, just like those at the borders. Wouldn't we build more if we wanted them to stay? It's a matter of need, not politics. Like children staring through confined cages at the border, the pup pleaded with eyes that pledged fidelity, but changed allegiance after deputies fed him. Reunited when they found his chip, it was an easy fix. Still, he was lost for 4 days. So many chipless children still waiting.
And that was Lost Lab by Macy Walshaw. It has been interpreted visually by Janelle Thompson in an exhibition at the Out of the Woods Winery in Hayward. Our reader is Deanna Person, with whom we are speaking, along with Dan McLaughlin of Out of the Woods. And Dan, what works made the most impression on you?
What about you, Dan?
I told you the last time we did this, no more sad poems, because I think I cried like six times last time. So this, you know, coming out of COVID, was some of the poems were very emotional and tear-jerking. But I loved the poem about speaking words in the winter and how the frost will grab them. And it's kind of a funny poem about a guy who proposes to his girlfriend in the middle of winter here. And by spring, you know, the words freeze and she doesn't hear them. And by spring, she's married another guy. So it's kind of a, everyone had a good laugh. That was a good emotional break, I think, from all the heaviness.
Did the artwork make you laugh too?
It's not a funny image, but it's a funny poem. The poem is entitled Wisconsin Frost, and it's by Bruce Henson. And the artist was Jeffrey Williams, and Jeffrey is a photographer. So it has that crisp, frosty look to it in the early morning, but it also lets the humor of the poem show through. Wisconsin Frost. You may have heard what can happen to words when the temperature falls to extremes. Nouns start to stick, adverbs get slick, and sentences crack at the seams. Once on a farm, or so goes the yarn, a love of a lifetime was lost. Wisconsin's no place for a winter embrace when everything's covered in frost. The thermometer showed it was 60 below. Young McShaw thought that milking would fail. Each time he'd pinch, the poor cow would flinch, and milk hit the pan like a nail. That morning, McShaw asked Wendy McGraw on his knees for her hand to be wed. But he asked her outdoors whilst doing the chores, and she heard not a word that he said. The words that he chose quickly thickened and froze and fell to the ground like cold lead. And before they could thaw in the spring, Miss McGraw married Robert O'Connell instead. So you see, it is true what can happen to you if you talk when the mercury's low. Crickets that sing and frogs in the spring are just words that were chilled long ago.
Now, you know what? I'm guessing that the author, Bruce Henson, may have heard the same joke I did about 30 years ago. I almost want to say it came from Farley Moab, and it's a joke of two Arctic explorers, and one of them says to the other, where we were, it was so cold that the flame to our fire froze. And the other person says, that's nothing. Where we were, it was so cold that the words fell out of our mouth and froze, and we had to thaw them to see what we were talking about.
Oh my God.
So, two great minds with the same thought. You know, I'm wondering if there was one, in all seriousness, where the art didn't match. And I don't mean missed a point or anything like that, but the art was more, let's simply say, abstract, right? So that the poem maybe was or wasn't literal, but that the artistic representation, you know, had a life of its own.
Well, that's kind of interesting. There's a couple that come to mind, and one of them is my piece. It's called The Keening. The poem was written by Jude Genero, and I worked with encaustic wax. If you would look at it, you wouldn't immediately go, oh, yes, The Keening, but you wouldn't look at it and go, oh, this is a happy piece. Mm-hmm. So I think it carried the flavor without being directly carrying the message. It's called The Keening, K-E-E-N-I-N-G. There came a medieval keening through the village late in the dark of that mild spring night. The neighbor who first heard it looked to the cemetery. Nothing could be seen. Only a heap of darkness collapsed in front of the newest black tombstone as a wail of sorrow lifted skyward. Sailing through the black locust tree branches, flaring out over the sleeping hamlet, raising scruffs on local dogs and prickling the backs of those still awake. No one who heard the sound was left to wonder what it meant.
All right. Well, I think that will wrap it up. That was The Keening by Jude Genero, who has actually been on the show before reading her poetry.
Can I give you one more?
Sure.
It's short, and this one is done by a Native artist, Shamakwa Nabawi, and he did an interpretation of a poem by Roberto Palumbi. And Shamakwa's paintings are storytelling, and this was about a great storm that happened here in the area, and it's called Remembrance. Nine trees are storm-toppled at the first light. The native woman on each trunk sprinkles tobacco, thanking them for their life lived.
Okay. We have been speaking with and listening to Deanna Person and also speaking with Dan McLaughlin of the Out of the Woods Winery, which is hosting the Nature of Relationship, a collaboration of poetry and artwork done to that poetry. It is being featured at the Out of the Woods Winery at 10588 Main Street in Hayward, across the street from the post office. The exhibit will be up through November 30th. Thank you for joining us, Deanna and Dan.
Thanks, Robin. That was fun.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate it.
Coming up, the regional news and review. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Rick Lovers, the executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
And we also have a report from our own Danielle Kading of WPR News about a possible merger of 911 services between Ashland and Bayfield counties. Here's Danny's report.
Ashland and Bayfield counties are splitting the cost of a roughly $50,000 feasibility study that will examine equipment, staffing, and operation of a potential joint dispatch center. Bayfield County Emergency Management Director Megan Corderer says merging could help with staffing concerns.
Both counties are small, and there are financial restrictions for both counties on how much staff they can afford to fund.
Ashland County's administrator says they sometimes operate with only one dispatcher on staff for part of the day. The two counties aren't the only ones considering a merger. The city of Mequon is consolidating its emergency dispatch services with the Ozaukee County Sheriff's Office, due largely to staffing constraints. In Milwaukee, the city's police and fire departments also plan to merge operations into one call center. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And that was Danielle Kading of WPR News. So, Rick, speaking of 911 calls or the people at the other end of those calls, the city of Duluth officially has a new police chief.
Yes, it does. Mike Sonoa, who was a lone finalist in the running to become the city's next police chief, was officially appointed to the post Monday night when the city council confirmed his contract. Sonoa is a 24-year veteran of the Duluth Police Department, most recently serving as its deputy chief of patrol. Members of the council said that history with the local police force and the community should serve Sonoa well. In an earlier statement, Mayor Emily Larson said she worked with Mike as a trusted part of DPD's command staff for many years. He is thoughtful, inclusive, and deeply committed to his community. Larson ultimately selected Sonoa for the job, naming him to succeed Chief Mike Tuscan, who earlier announced his retirement. But the appointment in Sonoa's contract required council approval. Sonoa's beginning annual salary as police chief will be $161,000 annually. His raises in future years in the job will be commensurate with those negotiated by collective bargaining units in the police department. The Duluth police chief is considered an at-will position, with the person serving in that role at the discretion of the mayor.
All right. And continuing with emergency workers, several line workers from the Northland are headed to Florida to deal with Hurricane Ian.
Yes, they are. Northland line workers are headed to Florida to help restore power in the wake of powerful Hurricane Ian, which has slammed the west coast of that state with high winds and torrential rain and obvious power outages. A total of 24 line workers, supervisors, and mechanics from Minnesota Power and Superior Water, Light, and Power left the Twin Ports on Wednesday bound for the Jacksonville area. Crews are expected to be there for up to 2 weeks, the company said in a news release Tuesday. Minnesota Power received mutual assistance from other companies in 2016 after violent thunderstorms roared through the Northland with hurricane-force winds, downing trees, and leaving thousands without power. Crews from Minnesota Power and Superior Water, Light, and Power have provided mutual assistance to other areas after natural disasters, including six hurricanes in the past 15 years, notably to Puerto Rico from late 2017 and early 2018 after hurricanes Irma and Maria.
All right. And another talented person from the Northland traveled across the country to share his skills, this time in Hollywood.
Yes, actor Daniel Durant once again wowed judges and voters on Dancing with the Stars, easily advancing to a third week on the Disney Plus reality competition show. Durant of Duluth and his partner Britt Stewart danced a jive to the title song from the 1958 film King Creole. The catalog of Elvis Presley formed the basis of Monday's episode, a tribute to the King of Rock and Roll. The actors' mothers, Lori Durant and Mary Ingalls, even joined their son and Stewart for a few steps during a visit to the practice space. In an interview, Durant, who is hard of hearing, described being adopted at age one and said that 80% of hearing parents don't learn sign language for their deaf children. He said his mothers gave him his first language and that made him who he is today. Dancing in a black Elvis wig and a plum-colored suit, Durant impressed judges with his commitment to the character. Durant and Stewart were among the 14 couples advancing to a third week. The next episode of Dancing with the Stars will stream live on Disney Plus Monday, October 3rd at 7 p.m.
All right, so this wasn't just a one-time thing and he is advancing?
Yes, he is. There are 14 couples that are advancing to the third week of the competition, and Durant and Stewart are still in the running for the ultimate prize at the end of the show.
All right. Well, I think it's appropriate to wish the hometown favorite well. And the same goes for our Northland line workers in Florida. We've been speaking with Rick Lubbers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with Kid Creole from Daniel Durant's appearance in Dancing with the Stars. Stay safe, everyone. There's a man in New Orleans who plays rock and roll. He's a guitar man with a great big soul. He lays down a beat like a ton of coal. He goes by the name of King Creole. You know he's gone, gone, gone.